Our thoughts are so powerful and our thoughts are so important. That's what the series is about. The way life works, I'm sure you've realized this, but there are circumstances that happen. There's events that happen. And then all of a sudden we get feelings. We have these feelings about them. And I've recognized that people so often come to church or people go to a counselor or even seek relationships or job or money or wealth or status or security to just feel better. We all want to feel better. We all want to feel good, but it's a little counterintuitive when we realize that our feelings are really caused not by those circumstances, but our feelings are caused by our thoughts. Because in the gap between what happens and the way we feel, our mind tells us a story. Our mind tells us what to think. And what is too often true is that some of those thoughts are traps. They're not actually real. They're not true. They're giving us distortions of what's actually happening or what we're actually experiencing. So this series is called Mind Traps. We're talking about not just what to think, but we're really talking about how to think, or maybe even more importantly, how not to think, how to avoid some of those mindsets that have become mind traps. Because when our mindsets have become a mind trap, it's time for a mind change. And that's what my hope is for you. That's my hope for myself in this series. And so what we've done in this series is we basically just talked about maybe three of the most common cognitive distortions or mind traps that we could find ourselves in. We've got the victim's trap that we talked about week one, where we talked about Joseph, this Old Testament character who could have been a victim, could have felt like a victim, but decided to rise above it and experience freedom through victory and not through being a victim. Last week, we talked about the negativity trap. We talked about the Apostle Paul, who wrote such positive, forward-thinking, can-do, optimistic words, specifically in his letter called Philippians. But he doesn't say just be more positive to avoid negativity. No, he says, hey, rejoice, find joy, choose joy in your circumstances, and that's the key to breaking the negativity trap. But today, we're going to talk about the all or nothing trap, the all or nothing trap. What does it look like for us to see life as pass, fail, or black, white in this dichotomous way that there's got to be either one of two things, and if it's not this, then it must be this. I'm going to give you a couple of examples from my own life, and then we'll do some examples that I think everyone on different levels can relate to. Maybe you can relate to these from my own life as well. I'm standing up here, obviously, right now with a microphone, but this is only part of my job. This is not my whole job. This is just a percentage of my job. But how I do in this part of my job makes a pretty significant difference. It's the thing that I do that if I don't get it right, if it goes wrong, it's real easy for me to get caught up in all or nothing thinking. You've got that too in your job. Maybe it's the contracts that you read, or maybe you've got to give a presentation, or maybe it's your ability to sell work. Whatever that thing is, you know the feeling when someone gives you feedback on it and they tell you, hey, this is what we experienced. Then it's real easy to discount yourself. It's real easy to go, oh, since that didn't go well, I must be a failure, or something's wrong with me, or I'm a sham, or I'm broken, I'm flawed, I can't do this. It's amazing how that works in all of our worlds. I'm also a parent, and as a parent, one of the most embarrassing things that can happen as a parent is whenever we're in public and a child has some kind of tantrum or throws a fit. And sadly, that happens to me just like that happens to some of you as well. In fact, the other day I was at Costco and my kids were acting the fool. And one of them particularly was just not interested in sitting in that little basket up front that's designed for children to sit in. No, this child's two. And so this child decided, no, I want to sit in the bigger basket. I'm going to sit where all the groceries go. And I'm unfortunately, one of my flaws as a parent is I can be a little bit of a pushover. And so I gave in. I said, okay, you know, because you got to choose your battles. I said, all right, I'm going to go, well, that's fine, but you got to stay right in here, you know. So sure enough, I mean, we're down like maybe one aisle before he's standing up, surfing the grocery cart like he's riding some kind of wave. And this lovely gentleman, looked like a grandfatherly type man, he comes over to me and he says, you know what you're doing is extremely dangerous. I looked back at him and I said, you know, no one asked you. I'm just kidding. I didn't say that. I thought that, but I didn't say that. No, he walked away giving me this like completely judgmental look. Like, I can't believe they let you have these children. Like, this is wrong, you know? And immediately my thoughts did the same thing. My thoughts immediately condemned me. There's something wrong with you. I can't believe they let you have these parents, these kids, or these parents. I can't believe they let these kids have these parents. You're not cut out for this. You can't do this. Immediately, I found myself caught in the all or nothing trap. The all or nothing trap, just the definition of it real simply is the tendency to think in terms of polar opposites without accepting the possibilities that lie between these two extremes. The tendency to think that life is either this way or life is this way. And when something bad happens, what we often do is we go, well, obviously life can't be this way, so it must be this way. Maybe you've experienced this. Maybe you're single and you've been dating and you go on a first date with someone, or maybe you can remember when this happened. And the first date seemed to go well. You know, you got that congratulatory text at the end of the date, you know. Say, hey, I really enjoyed it. Can't wait to do it again. And you go, oh my goodness, I'm successful. Look at me. Like, I'm basically just a modern day Casanova. I'm really good at this. I've always thought I was, but look, here I am. I was working my game, and it was really, it would seem to be working. I feel successful. But then maybe others of you, maybe you've experienced a breakup in a relationship. Maybe even worse, maybe you've just recently gone through a divorce. Maybe it wasn't your first one. Maybe it was your second one, or maybe even your third one. And it's real easy in those moments when it doesn't work out to tell ourselves messages. Oh, well, since that didn't work, then I must be worthless. I'm damaged goods. Nothing good will ever happen to me. I knew I couldn't get it together, and sure enough, I can't. Or maybe you're in school, or maybe you have to pass some kind of exam. Maybe you know what that is like. Maybe it's a financial exam, or maybe it's an exam to get some sort of license, and you pass it and it goes well and you feel smart. Or maybe you didn't pass it and you failed it and you feel stupid. I remember when I was 15 and I took my learner's permit exam and I failed it. I couldn't believe it. And I remember thinking, I'm so dumb. I mean, I don't care what's happening at school. I feel so stupid. How could I not pass this? And I was embarrassed to tell other people. I was embarrassed to get back in the car and tell my parents, you're not going to believe this, but your kid's an idiot. I would imagine they probably would have been like, no, we believe it. We've kind of thought it, but no, maybe for you, maybe you're in the middle of some kind of new health regime. Maybe you started out this year and you thought, you know what? I'm going to do something different this year. I'm going to eat differently. I'm going to exercise differently. And maybe that went well for a week and you felt wonderful. You thought, this is just awesome. I'm like keeping it all up. I'm keeping it all together. I'm logging it in on the app. Everything's going well. I feel so wonderful. Or maybe a couple weeks later, the wheels came off and you went to a Mexican restaurant and ate the entire basket of chips, and you felt terrible. I have a friend, whenever I ask him about how his new health regime is going, he always tells me the same thing. He says, oh, I feel terrible. I'm at my slaughter weight right now. And I think that is a terrible way to talk about it. It makes me laugh, but a terrible way to talk about it. But that's the way all or nothing thinking works, that we're either awesome or we're terrible. Things are going great or things are not. What's interesting about all or nothing thinking, this dichotomous way of thinking, is that you know who the worst people in the world are at this? Are religious people. Religious people are great dichotomous thinkers. For years, religious people have used this all or nothing way of thinking to motivate us, not motivate us in love or motivate us in goodness, but to motivate us out of fear that if you're not this way, you must be this way. Religiosity is fueled by rigidity, that there's a right and there's a wrong, and if you miss it, you're done. And religious people, unfortunately, over the last however many years, have done a really great job of oversimplifying super complex issues with all or nothing thinking. Now, before you go too far and go, well, are you saying there's no absolutes in the world? Absolutely not. There are certainly things that are absolutely true. But what I've learned in life is that maturing faith understands nuance. A maturing faith understands that there are less things to be really certain about. And there are more things to be less certain about, but there are only a few things that we should really feel certainty around. That there are some things that we'll just never really be able to understand. There are some things that we'll never really know what to do with, but there are certain things in life, only a few of them, that we can be even more absolute with. Meanwhile, all or nothing thinking just keeps us from becoming who we really want to be. I'm telling you, this way of thinking is so damaging. It's damaging to ourselves, but it can be damaging to other people as well. It can create in us this desire for perfection. This is what all or nothing thinking does, is it moves us toward everything's got to be perfect. And any little thing that's wrong, we count ourselves out. We deem ourselves worthless. And then unfortunately, it pushes us into paralysis, where it makes us feel like, well, I can never really try. I can never really give my all, because what if I don't make it? Today, I want to give us another way. Today, I want us to look at the writings of a particular character in the life of Jesus who clearly was an all or nothing thinker. I mean, his natural way was either all in or completely out. It was never one way or the other. He wasn't lukewarm. He was either totally hot or totally cold. But we're going to read something that he actually wrote toward the end that is going to give us a little picture into his mind. This character I want to talk about today is Simon Peter. Simon Peter was a man of extremes. Simon Peter was one of the most interesting characters that ever followed Jesus, because he had such courage. He was an audacious person. And when he messed up big time. But when he went in with so much passion. You know, Peter wasn't necessarily a likely apostle. I would say Peter would be put in the category, like most followers of Jesus, as an unlikely apostle. We see Peter's following Jesus right at the beginning in Matthew chapter 4, where Jesus calls Peter. He invites him. Hey, would you be interested in following me? The apostle Matthew actually writes it this way. He says in Matthew 4 verse 18, that as Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw these two brothers, Simon, who would later on be known as Peter, and his brother Andrew. And they were casting net. They were casting a net into the lake. And I love this little piece of detail, because they were fishermen. That's what fishermen do. This was their profession. I would imagine if we were to speak to Peter in that stage of his life, Peter would say, yeah. I wasn't someone who you would have thought would have followed a rabbi. I didn't win the superlative in high school, most likely to become a pastor. That was not me. No, I was just fishing when Jesus said, come, follow me, and I will send you out to fish for people. And at once, they left their nets and they followed him. At once, they left what they were doing. They were so inspired by it, and Peter went all in. He started out as an unlikely apostle, but eventually Peter became one of the most profound characters in all of the events that surrounded Jesus because of some of the things he said. In fact, he said a statement that is one of the most pivotal foundational statements. Jesus said, I'm going to build everything on this statement. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus asks his followers a question. He says, hey, just curious, what's the crowd saying about me? What are people saying about me out there? And a couple of people said, oh, well, they're saying you're just another John the Baptist, or they're saying you're a prophet, that you're someone like Elijah. Then he looks at them in this very meaningful way and says, well, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And we can't read the emotion into what Peter said, but you just got to imagine. It was like Peter pushed everyone else out of the way and goes, oh, I know who you are. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Jesus says, Peter, on that statement, I'm going to build everything that I'm going to build after this. In fact, on that statement, I'm going to build my church. And Peter is known as the first pope or the first pastor, the first leader of the church. And it's interesting that Peter not only said profound things, but he did bold things. One of my favorite stories when I was a kid is what Peter did to the soldier. You remember this, at the very end of Jesus's life, he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he's praying with his closest followers. And these soldiers come to arrest him. And Peter gets out his sword. You remember what he does? He cuts the guy's ear off. He's like, not today, man. We're not having any of that. Peter was bold and audacious, confident, courageous. And just a few hours later, just a number of verses later, in fact, that account that Matthew wrote of Peter cutting off the soldier's ear, just after that, Peter standing outside of Jesus's trial, Jesus was in fact arrested and he was put on trial. When someone came up to Peter in the courtyard of the trial and said, you're one of his followers, aren't you? And the tide had turned at that point. Things didn't look good for Jesus. It wasn't as attractive to follow him in that moment. And so Peter did the unthinkable. He went from cutting someone's ear off to just moments later denying that he even knew Jesus. And then someone else came up. Another servant came up to Peter and said, no, I could have sworn I've seen you with him. Were you not with him? And Peter gets even more passionate. He says, absolutely not. I was not with him. I do not know him. And a third person comes up to Peter a few minutes later and says, no. I recognize your accent. I can tell even in your facial features that you're from the same region that he's from. And I'm pretty sure I've seen you with him. Aren't you one of his followers? And Peter said, no, I don't even know that man. And then it was as if the shame, the guilt, the condemnation of his own thoughts rushed in. And he runs away brokenhearted, beating himself up. How could you? How could you? But that wasn't the end of his story. No, Jesus actually reinstates Peter in this really beautiful way. After Jesus was resurrected, he's on a beach near a body of water having breakfast with his closest followers. And he has this poignant, this very personal moment with Peter that John chronicles for us. He tells us about it. He says that Jesus actually looked at Peter and asked him three times this question, do you love me? And we don't know if Jesus actually meant to do what it seemed like he did, but how many times did Peter deny Jesus? He denied him three times. How many times did Jesus ask him, do you love me? And he asked him three times, and surely there was a reason. Surely there was meaning behind the number of questions. But the third time Jesus asked him this, something different happened in Peter. How do we know that? Well, he gives a different answer, a slightly different answer that I want to show you. In John chapter 21, verse 17 says that Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. This was not something that he had said the first two times. The first two times Jesus just said, Peter, do you love me? And Peter said, yes, Lord, I love you. And he said, well, go feed my sheep. Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, I love you. Well, go take care of my flock. Peter, do you love me? Lord, you know all things. Well, what is Peter referring to here? We don't exactly know, but you would have to guess that he's saying, you know all things. You know that I wasn't supposed to be one of the people that were following you. But then I went all in. And you know that I made some serious statements that are meaningful and profound that matter. And you know that I was all behind you. You know that in that moment, I cut that soldier's ear off. You know I was with you when you calmed the storm. You know I was with you when you called me out on the water and I walked on the water to you. And then I had that moment where I doubted and I looked down and I started to sink. You know all those moments. And you know that in the moment when they asked me if I was with you, I said no. You know that moment too. You know all my good. You know all my bad. And you know that in all of that, I love you. I'm trying. I want so badly to show you. I just wonder if at some level Peter had to get free from this feeling that when I do the right thing, I'm all in. And when I don't, I'm out. See, that's not really what Peter teaches us in his letters, 1 Peter and 2 Peter. Now, he teaches us a concept that's really, it's more like the hobby of rock climbing. I don't know if any of you are rock climbers. You look like people that could. You just look very athletic and put together. And I have never understood rock climbing. I mean, what's the point, you know? Are you ever going to be in a situation where you're like, it's finally coming in handy, all those hours in the gym, and now I'm going to be able to make it to the top? And see, that's what's interesting is if you talk to people that rock climb, they would tell you, yeah, it's not even really about making it to the top. I mean, it's not even really about the goal. Or now we have those gyms, you know, that have the big walls with the bell at the top, you know. It's not really about ringing the bell, which I'm like, well, it can't be because there's a lift right behind the wall and we could just pull that out here and we could all go up to the bell. And I've rung many bells. It's not that fascinating to ring a bell, you know. It can't be about that. No, see, I mean, even marathons, I don't really understand marathons. I'm like, for what reason? What's the goal? What's the point? But at least there's a finish line, right? At least you get a sticker you can put on your car, which seems like the whole reason why people do it. But you know this to be true when it comes to rock climbing. It's like the whole point is the climbing. That's the point. The point is the struggle and the growth and the movement. It's like that amazing poet said, what was her name? Miley Cyrus. There's always going to be another mountain. I'm always going to want to make it move. Always going to be an uphill battle. Sometimes I'm going to have to lose. But it ain't about how fast I get there. It ain't about what's waiting on the other side. No, it's the climb. That's what it's about. And I know she performed that song as Hannah Montana, but I think there's a lot of application for us as adults. That maybe she's right. Maybe it is about the climb. Maybe it's about moving past where you are now and making it a little further. And do you ever get knocked down? Yeah, sure. But it's about getting back up and trying it again. And life is so much more about this journey than it is about this destination. And as long as we get trapped in all or nothing thinking, which by the way, I think we kind of like it. I think we kind of like this black or white way of life. Why? Well, because it's at least simple. We at least know when we're winning and we know when we're not. But limiting yourself, if you would choose to limit yourself to a pass-fail perspective, then you're going to limit how much God actually grows you. If you limit yourself to thinking of life as I've either made it or I didn't make it, my career was a success or it wasn't. That marriage either won or it lost. In all of life, if I either get it or I don't, that's going to determine all the value. It's either all or it's nothing. And if we get trapped in that, if we get locked in that, then we miss all of the growth that God wants for us. Life is way more about a laboratory of learning than it is an exam to pass or an exam to fail. And Peter seemed to eventually get this. How do we know this? Well, because of what he wrote. I mean, this is beautiful, but we have these two letters that give us a little insight into his mind. And so I want to pull out the very beginning of his first letter, creatively titled 1 Peter. I want to just pull out a couple of really simple verses that have profound concepts where we start to see that Peter even understood that on my good days, it's really all about him. And on my bad days, it's still really all about him. Here's what he said in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. He said, therefore, with minds that are alert and fully sober. I love that he starts there. He starts by saying, hey, it all begins in your mind. And you've got to get to a place where your mind is both alert, but also where it's fully sober. What does it mean for your mind to be alert? Eugene Peterson translates this in the Message. He says that our sleeves are rolled up and we're ready for action. We've got to approach our day that way. We've got to approach our life that way. That our minds have to be alert, sleeves rolled up, ready for action, on the lookout for any distortion that we're involved in, any trap that's keeping us from thinking the way God would want us to think. And then we've got to be fully sober. I look up the definition in the original language of what it means to be fully sober, and it means not drunk, which makes a lot of sense. But then I started thinking, well, what kind of thoughts? Why is our mind getting intoxicated? What kind of thoughts are intoxicating our mind? And maybe it is this victim's mentality or this negative thought that we just enjoy for some reason. Or maybe it's this all or nothing way that we just like because we at least know, am I winning or am I losing? We really enjoy it when it comes to other people. We love telling other people, yeah, you're done. Wow, you really made it. And he says, you got to keep your mind in a state of alertness and fully sober so that you can do something, so that you can what? Well, he tells us, so that you can set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. He points to something in the future. He says there's going to be a day where Jesus is going to return and make all things right. This is known as the second coming of Christ. That as followers of Jesus, this is what followers of Jesus believe, that there is going to come a day at the end where Jesus is going to come and be the final judge. And he's going to determine who's in and who's out. And he's going to give an account in that moment of what we did with our life. And he says, in that moment, I am depending on grace. Because if I try to add up all the good and hope that it outweighs all the bad, I don't know that it will. And so he's telling us the secret is to set your hope on grace. Well, what is grace? Grace is getting that thing that you didn't deserve. Grace is getting the mercy given to you that you didn't earn. Grace is God's way of making things right. Grace is Jesus. Jesus is grace. Grace is that he went to the cross to pay for our sin. Grace is that he lets us share in his resurrection. That there's nothing that can hold us down. There's nothing that can hold us back because of the life that he won for us. That's grace. Peter says, the only way I know how to make it out of this all or nothing trap is to depend on grace, is to set my hope on grace. So would you do that? Would you keep your mind alert and fully sober? And would you choose to set your hope on grace? And then he ends this little section with this really challenging, maybe even a little hard to understand, conversation about holiness. Here's what he says. He says, as obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires that you had when you lived in ignorance. Evil desires. What is it? Anytime we think something for someone else that is not healthy or good for them, anytime we have negative thoughts about ourselves, anytime we want things that aren't necessarily ours to want, anytime we desire something more than we desire him, he contrasts this. He says, don't be conformed to these evil desires. No, instead, but in contrast, but just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. I've always thought of holiness as perfection, completely right, all good, amazing, without any imperfection. He says, for it is written, be holy because I'm holy. Remember when God said this, Peter's saying? God himself said it. Be holy because I'm holy. To which I would go, I can't. I mean, I want to, but I can't. And I would guess Peter would go, me neither. Yeah, I can't either. I tried. Man, I tried. I was cutting people's ear off. I was trying so hard. But but I couldn't. So then what do we do with this? What do we do with this command? Hey, go be holy. I think we see it as our mountain to climb. I think we take it on with joy and go, this isn't to determine whether we're in or whether we're out. This is because holiness is just God's way. And God's way is the best way. So don't make holiness the goal. Make it the guardrails. Don't make holiness the destination. No, make it the journey. Set your eyes, set your heart, set your hope on grace. And let holiness propel you along the way. This way, not this way. This way, not this way. Focus on growth. Focus on, God, I want you to make me a better person tomorrow than I am today. Not so that you'll love me more. Not so that I could get counted in. No, because it's just your way. Your way is just better. You've already called me a son. You've already called me a daughter. So would you let me just keep moving on the road of holiness? Let it be the guardrails, not the goal. I'm telling you, I think the way we break out of this all or nothing thinking is to keep our minds alert and sober. Is to set our hope, set our heart on grace, and to focus on growth. Let holiness lead us to grow. My hope for all of us in this series is that God would use this to change our minds. All of us, if we were to take up a bunch of prayer requests, hey, what are you praying for? What are you praying for? It would probably be about circumstances in our life. I wish this would change. I wish this would be different. I wish this would be better. I wish this person would be worse. Unfortunately, some people have prayer requests like that. But I wonder if through all this, God would let us go, God, my prayer is that you would let our mind change. Give us different thoughts. Give us your thoughts. Paul called it the mind of Christ, that we would put on the mind of Christ every day. Why? Well, because that's the only hope we have for change. Because there isn't any change. In fact, there's no change that holds as much potential for life change as letting God give you a mind change. There is no change. There isn't any amount of change that holds as much potential for life change as asking God, would you give me a mind change? Would you change my thoughts? If you're not going to change my circumstances, would you change my thoughts? Don't let me get caught up in a victim's trap. Don't let me get caught up in the trap of negativity. And give me freedom from this all or nothing way that wants to hold me hostage. Because there's no change like the life change that comes from God giving us a change of mind. And so as we pray to finish this, I would just love to invite you to pray with me. In fact, some of you, maybe you're going through something right now, or maybe it would be helpful for you to have someone pray for you specifically and personally. In fact, we have a room, we call it the studio. If you just walk out in the lobby, it's over on this side of the building. And as you're walking past the studio, I would just invite you. We've got a team of people that would just love to pray for you. And there might not be anything tragic going on right now. There might be, God forbid. But we would love the privilege of being able to just pray for you. For some of you, you need to get in some new relationships. It's amazing how the people that we surround ourselves with, they either help our minds or they hurt our minds. And if you haven't experienced the power of being in a small group of people with the same goal in mind, maybe today's your day to do that. You're going to be handed a little card that's got some, we call them short-term groups. Short-term groups because they might last anywhere from 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks, in some cases 8 weeks. And we've got trained, amazing mentors and facilitators leading those groups. And we would love to invite you to sign up for one of those. We'll make it as easy as possible for you, but ultimately you've got to decide that this is something I want. And then next week, we're kicking off a brand new series called You're Not Far. Because at some point, every one of us has felt far from God. But the great news is that because of Jesus, we're way closer than we ever thought we could have been. And we'd love for you to be back next week to join us. Maybe even invite somebody to be here with you. But until then, I'd love to invite you to pray with me now. So if you would, bow your head, close your eyes. Heavenly Father, we just thank you. Thank you for the story of Joseph. Thank you for giving us so much about his life. Thank you for Paul. God, none of us would even be here in a church if it weren't for Paul. God, thank you for Peter. I know so many people here can probably relate to his boldness, but unfortunately, so many of us can relate to what it feels like to make the wrong decision and to feel like we're counted out. And God, I pray that today, that the lead story of the day would be the grace of Jesus, that we would all leave here just a little bit more happy, a little bit more joy-filled, not because our circumstances have changed, but because we're fixed on your grace, because our hope is depending on your grace. We need you. We thank you for Jesus, for his death and for his resurrection. We thank you for the hope that he brings us. And we pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen. Hey, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope you have a fantastic rest of your Sunday. We'll see you back here next week, or we'll see you this week on social media. Thanks.